Welcome to the third podcast of Year of Wonders. I hope you enjoyed that music. Quite inspirational, but a bit of a change. All right, so we're going to be looking at chapters 2 to 4, and this is more of an overview of those chapters as opposed to breaking down and killing any interest you might have had in the actual book itself by going chapter by chapter, which is a bit tedious for everyone involved. All right, so looking at the first of the chapters, which is chapter 2. Now, there might be a little bit of repetition in terms of what I'm going to say just to start off with, but bear with me, okay? All right, so we've got the idea that Michael had some idea of the source of the illness when he took up George's warnings to burn everything. So we've got that whole idea of disease and the spread of disease. So there's an element of him being quite aware of sort of the Enlightenment scientific rational aspect of things at the time. So this is, and his education is clearly coming through, although it doesn't really last because he's also responsible for writing to friends, him and Eleanor in Cambridge, to get these ridiculous remedies later on for Anna's boys. Annis turns up in chapter 2 and is presented to the reader as somebody that's quite unusual for her time. She's a woman who describes her life and her intimate relationships as saying to Anna when she says, well, why would you cultivate a garden with only one plant in it when you could have a garden of a whole range of plants and pretty much do what you like and be free. The villagers do fear her. They are kind of more afraid of her, I think, than they are of Mem. Mem's a bit older and a bit more kind of blunted in terms of the threat that she poses. Although, you know, obviously that kind of bears out. The fear kind of overrides any respect that they might have had for Mem later on. Anna's definitely jealous of Annis. The allure that somebody like her has for the men and the travellers that kind of come into contact with her. And that scarlet dress that George makes up for Annis is definitely something that is indicative of the passion and the very elemental nature that Annis sort of presents to men. It's a contrast to the dress that George made up for Anna herself. That when she burns it, you've got that kind of blending of the golden green gashed by flames of bright vermilion. So you've got that kind of blending of the red that came, that she was thinking of in terms of Annis's dress, and the green gold of her own. The patriarchal dominance of the time is something that was sort of on a wider scale was actually coming into quite a social kind of reevaluation. And the Gaudis are definitely kind of representational of that re-evaluation. So when Anna says that she and her aunt are just the latest in a long line of women on page 51, they're sort of harking back to those women that have managed to fly under the radar in terms of herbal healing and village wise women, but also kind of leading the charge towards a changing nature of women's roles in society during this latter half of the 17th century. So Anna is very much still in that transitional period of, or stage of, being a lot like the villagers. She was afraid of Annis and afraid of her quick tongue and courage, basically, even when she was a child and came to live with her aunt. And she stood up to the snotty-nosed children of the village. And then when she was pregnant, she actually sought Annis out and kind of realised the value that Annis had. And you can kind of take that a little bit further in terms of there's a fear, but there's also a respect of Annis, and it's something that Anna kind of transfers later on to Eleanor as well. So Anna's open enough at this stage to kind of admit that she is actually jealous of this woman, jealous of her knowledge, her freedom, her ability to kind of do as she pleases and not be beholden to any man or sort of social expectation. Annis tells Anna that the incident that happened between her and George was naught more to either of us than a meal to a hungry traveller, which I think is actually a really nice way of putting it. It's a sustenance as opposed to anything more serious. And the fact that George confided in Annis about Anna and his intentions towards her is a mark of how men actually valued Annis as well. Anna does want Annis's good opinion. She does admire her for listening to her own heart, and this is something that, as a process of character development, is something that Anna herself will actually find the courage to do by the end. When she kind of leaves the cottage and she's walking towards the hall, you get that really interesting kind of binary opposition of light and dark and the link to the Puritans, and also perhaps the darkness that's actually going to be traveling alongside her in terms of what's going to happen with the disease coming to Eme. It also perhaps foreshadows the choice of human nature that the village itself is going to have to face, and also the people individually will have to face themselves as well. When she gets to the hall and she sees Colonel Bradford, he is the worst kind of social superior, so it's almost like he's a caricature of somebody of the time. His son has been indulged, and he himself is actually abusive of his position as a husband and a social leader. The women around him, Anna describes as being tensed like a cur waiting for the boot, so a dog waiting to be kicked, basically. So he's a bully, but at the heart of every bully is a coward, and he's very much shows himself to be like that when he gives the order to leave the area when the plague actually does end up being there. Arriving. And perhaps Anna's ability to see the fear that the women have is something that would come from her own experience and sort of tiptoeing around and trying to stay out of the way of her own father too. When Montpellier takes on Bradford and his popinjay guest and his ridiculous outfit and wig and powdered face about their social attitudes, what he's doing is showing himself apart from the majority of the clergy at the time, and perhaps the ruling classes as well, when he kind of challenges them on their responsibilities as social superiors to look after those people who are less fortunate than themselves and more vulnerable, not only physically, perhaps, but also financially as well. At least the Bradfords have the financial means to leave and go and live somewhere else, whereas these people in Eme were physically reliant on family living around them and in other villages, and if they chose not to support them or look after them, then they were pretty much stuck. So with Montpellier, after the, you know, Montpellier staying, not only is he unusual in staying from a religious point of view, but he's showing himself again as being somebody quite different from the other clergy who saw the opportunity in the cities as soon as the plague cropped up and started, you know, cutting through swathes of people dying. They took off along with the nobles. He shows a remarkable strength of character in staying, although we'll get to the point a little bit later on, maybe in the next podcast, where perhaps he's not doing out of purely selfless reasons. He's very much seeing this as a selfish kind of action on his part. Okay. Okay, well, I hope that gave you a quick chance to perhaps pause it and get ready for the next section, which is chapter 3. So we see the encounter that happens between Anna and Michael in this chapter is a really different relationship of between Eleanor and Anna. It's very formal. It's very much Anna holds him in high esteem, whereas Eleanor, she's far more relaxed. Perhaps it could be a gender sort of thing. It could be just the sheer education that Michael holds that she respects. The readings that come from Augustine of Hippo, which is actually on Africa's coast, at this point seems a world away, like a parallel universe almost. It's exotic, it's foreign. Although what Brooks is doing here is foreshadowing the fate of Anna and the fact that she will actually travel to these exotic, wonderful places and read texts like this later on. Her thirst for knowledge is something that's kind of gathering pace. It's strengthening under Eleanor's guidance. She's actively encouraging it, which is makes her a rarity during this time. The fact that there's a woman who is wanting another woman to kind of become educated. Remember, women weren't educated back then. There was seemed to be no value in educating women because they were simply seen as being chattels or property of the men in their lives. And to educate women was to pretty much invite danger, get all these ideas and things. The social order would just be completely disrupted. So, yeah, not a good idea. But so Anna's kind of interest in where he's coming from is something that is a little bit of a hint of how this is gathering pace for her. There's a cyclical nature of the environment. So there's discussed in this chapter, there's hints to the Enlightenment movement of the time, which kind of answers to the world around, the answers to the world around them can be found in science and not necessarily in religion. And this is an area in which it's not explicit, but it's going to be an implicit journey for both Michael and Anna, especially Anna. But we'll come to that a little bit later on. And there's a really lovely incident in this chapter as well, where Jamie throws these rose petals, and Anna's kind of marveling at the beauty of this. Is kind of beautiful and terrible at the same time, because it's the last time that she kind of gets with her two boys in this beautiful kind of environment where she just appreciates the simplicity of having them around her. And everything kind of goes really dark from this point. The apples make another reappearance in this chapter, and the rats as well on page 71. So the harvest, the apples, the Hadfield's children are playing with them like they're toys. And Anna's comment about the fleas and the warm weather is ironic, because she doesn't realize how close to the truth she probably is about this. You have Edward Hadfield being leeched by the surgeons, and this is a really common treatment for the time. Keep in mind that leeching actually still happens. It's something that is seen to be of value, so it's not like a completely ridiculous treatment, although for this particular disease it's pointless because it just drains the strength out of the people that are actually being leeched. And so what would happen is they would put leeches on the infected areas, and the leeches actually latch on and suck out the poison or the bad blood, as it were. And then when they get fat, they kind of get pulled off or salted off. They kind of curl up when they have salt. They come into contact with salt. And this was seen as a good remedy for illness. Lancing was another excellent method used, where they would actually lance or cut the skin and then drain the blood, because they thought that by draining the blood they would what was called balance the humours, so that the humours are kind of components within the system that needed balancing out. And sometimes people were thought to have too much of a bad humour, so they would bleed them and balance them back out again. With Edward Hadfield being leeched by the surgeon, the audience gets some insight as to how the medical profession is treating the disease at the time, and the arrogance that this guy shows to Anna, and her, and that imperious kind of behaviour towards her when she comes out and she says, "Yes, but I had this guy die in my cottage," basically, and he said, well, kind of washes his hands of the situation and leaves really, really quickly. Which again echoes what the surgeons in the cities were doing as well. So the whole idea of the Hippocratic Oath, you know, where you undertake to kind of heal and look after the ill and the sick, seems to kind of get forgotten in the need for self-preservation in the face of this massive wave of plague. Afra later on tells Anna that she's actually a fool to get too attached to her children, and this perhaps comes down to being Afra's own coping mechanism. I mean, she's lost children of her own, and perhaps the sense of impermanence of anything in her life could also have something to do with her fear of Joss and the power that he has over her and the potential that he has to do her harm and her children harm as a result of his own drinking too. So it's when you're looking at what Aphra's saying and the whole superstitious charm and warning to Anna, think about what's motivating her to say this. She's not educated. She's someone that has grown up in a very particular small little environment, whereas Anna's being exposed to all these different ideas and ways of thinking, and she's curious, whereas Aphra doesn't want to know. She just wants the known. So that's kind of a fundamental difference between the two women. Anna refuses to buy into that whole superstitious gesture, and she throws her stepmother's offering on the fire, which kind of shows that she's her own person, and she's not willing to take anything necessarily at face value, that she's willing to kind of be open-minded about things. So when Eleanor comes along, you see a really stark difference between Eleanor and Aphra in terms of the common sense and the love and the understanding of what Anne is going through, even though Eleanor herself is not a mother. She was, as we haven't found out yet, but she was pregnant. But she's very much someone that kind of uses that maternal instinct to nurture those people around her that are in need of kind of mothering and love, essentially. Okay, so that's a brief overview of chapter three. And I'm going to give you another blast of excellent music now, just to kind of give you a bit of a break before we hit chapter four. Okay. So, chapter four, The Sign of a Witch, opens with Anna retelling a story that her father used to tell them as children, where people would be punished with the whip, so that the blows fell time and again on the same place where the skin had already been peeled in long strips. The most skillful, he said, could land the lash so exactly as to work right through the muscle until the very bone lay bare. Jamie is dying. Tom has already died, and what Anna's doing here is she's comparing the death of Tom and the whip of the lashing of grief that she's feeling over Tom is now being used again with the death of Jamie. She acknowledges that the treatments that they use on Jamie may have prolonged his death and his suffering as well. And you have to remember that the treatments at this time were primitive, to say the least. There's elements that she and Eleanor haven't yet crossed over into the Gowdies' territory completely, that they rely on the learnedness of these men that have been written to in Cambridge that are colleagues of Michael's. And some of the things that they tried were horrific, say the least. So Anna on page 82 says that she had already tried cataplasms of bay salt and rye meal made into a paste with egg yolk and strapped across the sore with a piece of soft leather. But the tumor just continued to grow from walnut size to the dimensions of a goose egg. It resisted to burst. So it's this massive infection that's growing and growing and growing, but it's really hard and solid. Even though it's filled with this bloody pus. It's solid. It's not movable. It doesn't kind of it's malleable under the hands. It's this rock solid kind of growing tumor. Michael's friend had written out in detail something to try, which was basically roasting a huge onion, which they would then hollow out, fill with a fig, chopped roux, and a dram of Venice treacle. So Mem Gowdy had the figs and the treacle, which they used, and I thought it was actually quite a fortunate thing. It turns out she was wrong on that one. Not Mem Gowdy, Anna, who then roasted the onions and then put these, if you can, I mean, you've all seen what a roasted onion or a roasted vegetable looks like. It's kind of like that soft fibre kind of thing. But if you've ever eaten onion, you've or roasted onion, it's sweet, but it's got that kind of acidic tang. So if you can imagine that having been hollowed out, filled with all this chopped kind of other material, and then strapped to this massive solid tumor where it's incredibly painful. It's all inflamed around where the bubo is. And it's been strapped. And this is a small child. He's not old at all, Jamie. And this poor little kid is actually being tormented by these primitive kind of remedies that they're trying on him through desperation, if nothing else. Anna Scaldi turns up and she gives Jamie something that helps the pain but doesn't promise a cure. And it's something those around her, and this is Anna and Eleanor as well, don't fully appreciate the knowledge and the skill that she has. The plague tokens are blooming, and they're like the rose petals that actually Jamie was throwing in the last chapter. And they're blooming on his skin now, and they're going from purple and turning black and getting all crusty as well. So the body's purging itself of this bacterial infection. And this is the point where Anna starts questioning her face. And the words that are used to explain what's happening, coming from, say, Michael and what she's taught in the Bible and that kind of thing, are at odds with how she's feeling in a very real kind of sense about the situation. So the attack on Mem Gowdy comes because Mary Hadfield blames her for the deaths of her family, essentially. Not the barbaric surgeon who left the Hadfields to their own devices, but the Gowdies who actually tried to help Edward. And it does defend Mem. Although she suffers at the hands of the crowd, there's two possible reasons that she could be helping. One, because, as someone pointed out in class today, she's got nothing left to lose. Like, she's lost Sam, Tom has died, Jamie is dying. So she's actually got nothing left to lose on this front. The other thing is, you can consider it that she's being incredibly brave, and she's acting because she knows that this isn't the right thing to do, that it's just a fundamentally evil, horrible, insane kind of thing for the crowd to be doing. Mem's punished by the crowd because Anna's actually pushed to the side and she hits her head, so she's knocked unconscious. So Mem is kind of defenseless and left to the crowd and vigilanteism that's sort of overtaken. If you've ever seen a riot where, say, you take the recent London riots or riots on the news, people are carried by a tide of emotion. They're not rationally thinking about what they're doing. They're kind of caught up in the heat and the frenzy of the moment. And this is what's happening in this chapter with Mem. Mary does feel guilty about accusing Mem of witchcraft. Even though Lib does turn around and also accuses Annis of witchcraft, she was able to save and somewhat redeem herself as well with Mem, because she's the one that actually goes and gets Michael to kind of snap them back out of whatever's going on. Unfortunately, because Anna saw fit to reveal to Libby about the whole George Annis sort of intimate interaction, Annis then becomes the crowd's target after Mem saved, as though somehow rescuing Mem, Annis proved her witchcraft ability, and she becomes this focal point for the crowd. And it's really interesting because if you think about the way that Anna describes the wind as Gabriel's hounds, the whole idea of heavenly connotations and the fact that there's something kind of binary oppositional happening in terms of the good and evil. You've got the evil of the crowd, the evil dark side of humankind, and you've got this heavenly kind of wind that's coming through, and it's almost like it's sweeping up and stirring up all of these emotions, and it's sorting out the good and the bad within this crowd. Annis's confession is the only weapon that she's got left available to her. She mocks the crowd, she uses their insecurities, the horrible sides of her own natures. And the fantastic thing about Annis here is that she's unafraid. She is not a coward in any way, shape or form. While they're all kind of hiding and
as a group. She is not afraid to stand up and be the individual and really just take them on here. And so if you have a look at page 93, there's a description, sort of second paragraph down. The sun slipping below the horizon found a narrow slit in the lowering clouds. Beautiful. Through it, sudden and swift, beamed a lonely finger of light. It sped over the hillsides, touching each tree and stone until it reached Annis and lit her up as though she were on fire. Her amber eyes glinted yellow as a cat's. Michael tells the crowd that Annis used your own ugly thoughts and evil doubting of one another as a way of getting back at them. And he turns around at the end of the chapter and said, is there not death enough here for all of you that you bring the crime of murder amongst us as well? Gird yourselves and pray that God does not exact from you the price that this day's deeds deserve. Arguably, you could say that he uses this as a launching pad for the drastic measures that he suggests to the village that they put into place as a way of purging this evil. I think that's probably my favourite little one so far. Okay, sad but true. All right, chapter 5, Venom in the Blood. Now, the idea that venom is something that is externally injected, that it's both poisonous and easily absorbed into the blood, so it's not like, say, for instance, a splinter, which you can physically remove and see it as a separate thing. The whole idea of venom is that it gets into the bloodstream and it mingles with what's there in the blood, that it can be removed. By extraction requires skill and a timeliness about it. So it's got to be done within a certain period of time, otherwise it kind of gets absorbed and integrated into the system as a whole. And this is pretty much what's happening now as a result of the Gowdies being murdered. Now, winter's well and truly set in by this point, both on a metaphorical level and also a physical level. So the village has been locked in by the snow, but also by their actions. It's kind of like they've gone beyond the pale. They've stepped over an invisible moral boundary into like unfamiliar territory. And so their mortality and their morality has kind of been locked in and perhaps frozen in some respects as well. Now Mem dies, but she dies from the drowning and the subsequent kind of weakening of her system of being dunked in the water. And because she dies, the local herb lore that kind of had been nurtured by her and her niece dies with her. And so the villagers have acted in haste and lost generations of knowledge as a result of their immoral actions. The size of the village is actually pretty small. So I'm figuring around 360 people, give or take, and I could be wrong on that figure. The Sunday that follows Mem's death, Michael's not actually in his pulpit. He's actually out talking to Parson Stanley, who was the pastor of the village until he stepped down 3 years before. Now, what I want you to do is also look up St. Bartholomew's Day and the Book of Common Prayer, because the fact that they're both mentioned in this chapter, there's relevance for them. And I'll give you the heads up a little bit. St. Bartholomew apparently was one of the 12 apostles, also known as Nathaniel. And the Book of Common Prayer was the book of worship, okay, that was used at the time. But there's also a conflict. Remember, I was talking earlier about the whole idea of change in the religious structure and the social structure. The Book of Common Prayer is kind of fundamental to that, the change. So going back to the sermon that Michael then gives the Sunday after her death. He recommends that the village uses the opportunity to remove the venom from the blood. So basically remove the evil that's kind of seeped into the village as a way of kind of purging them. So if you think back to the crucible and the whole idea that the crucible is something that is a purifying force up inside their houses, like literally nail them in, mark their doors with large red crosses and write, God have mercy on them. There would be no one that would deliver food or medicine or water. They were just basically locked in there and left to die.
Michael actually sees what's happening to the village as a religious test. So it kind of picks up what I was saying about the end of the previous chapter in chapter 4, that this is a way of purging the village of evil. And given what we learn about him at the end, you could also argue that it gives him and Eleanor an opportunity to purify themselves further as well, especially him taking that rather patronizing attitude where he wants to purge Eleanor of her sin of getting pregnant at 14, God forbid, with an older man who deceived her, but we'll get into that a bit later. From a more enlightened, modern viewpoint, what it does is it also quarantined the disease as well. So not only did it stop the disease from spreading beyond the boundaries of Eam, it locked people in to the village, although they voluntarily did kind of go along with this decision for the most part. It also prevented people from being turned away from other villages or family members who were afraid of catching the disease. So it's a preventative, but it's also something that held people in a very tightly confined little space. There are elements of dissent that come through in this chapter. So Joss Bond is seen as disagreeing with a small kind of group of people who aren't entirely happy with this decision. This later is going to have a huge impact on the village, and you could also argue that they are the poison in the blood that will need to be removed, although we don't necessarily realize it at this point. But if you look at the actions of Joss and Aphra and some of the others, you can see why it's important that Brooks puts their dissent in at this early stage. The fact that the Bradshaws depart isn't really so much of a surprise to Anna. She goes into a bit more detail about this later on in the next chapter. Michael actually needed Thomas Stanley, so I'm just kind of jumping around a little bit, sorry. Thomas Stanley, he needed him, even though he lived apart from the village. His faith of Puritanism was actually tolerated under the new regime, or the restoration of Charles II. He chose to follow the rules that said that he needed to live at least 5 miles from his old parish. So Michael shows himself to be tolerant of other people, as long as it's not his wife, and turned a blind eye and also recognised the influence that Thomas Stanley had in the village, which is why it's necessary for Stanley to kind of agree to this plan of Michael's. The effects of the religion are of central concern to the villagers, and Michael does bring this to the fore with a suggested isolation. So he's doing it very much from a religious point of view, because that's really arguably the only point that a lot of these people would understand. It's not going to be from a medicinal point of view or a social point of view. It's more going to be the moral, religious point of view. The novel as a whole does actually question the validity of religion, how the segregation of these beliefs can actually engender or encourage a narrow viewpoint of the world. But also it sets up later on the journey in which it can be used to overcome personal beliefs for the greater good. So even though Anna goes through a process of evaluating her own personal beliefs, she acts for the greater good, even though she has doubts about the validity of God using this as a way of punishing the village or the country. Michael sees this as a test, so he's very sort of clear about where he's going with this particular argument. And the whole idea, I think, you know, as someone said in class today, he must have had an incredible force of personality to be able to get up on that pulpit and actually convince the village to follow him with this extraordinary kind of plan. Whether the villagers make the decision because they do so as out of a duty to God, or because they're afraid that if they leave they wouldn't be allowed into other towns, is actually a really brave move on their part, and a very trusting move that the people on the other side of the boundary would still supply them with the necessities that they need. Their faith is actually tested to the extreme, but also you could argue that their faith in humanity is also tested as well. The idea that even though somebody's suffering, you can actually put their suffering ahead of what you need is something that's kind of remarkable, and it does actually, it is a wonder in
the most terrible and awesome kind of way, to see those people that kind of rise to the top and be that sort of shining example of what the best of human nature is like. There are also the ones whose worst, the worst side of their nature comes out, and Joss and Aphra, I think probably more for me Joss than Aphra. I think Aphra kind of loses the plot with the death of her child and when she gets thrown into the pit, whereas Joss is just a nasty piece of work who kind of exploits the suffering and grief of those people around him. You could argue that the Gowdy's death is something that for Michael was the turning point, and he needed to do something drastic in order to check or hold in check the, this kind of disintegration of the society that they are living within. So that's why he proposes such an extreme kind of solution to this problem. Okay, well, that is pretty much a very rushed kind of podcast summary. It's actually chapters 2 to 5, not chapters 2 to 4. Sorry, I kind of had that extra chapter at the end. I thought, well, might as well just throw it in. What I will do in the next podcast is kind of do the same sort of thing. And I'm going to also do a podcast on the various sort of themes that kind of crop up in the book that come from the classwork that we're doing, and something that you can use as a springboard to kind of add your own notes to as well. Okay, well, thank you for listening, and I will catch you next time.